Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. And did Michael Bloomberg make us richer? All this week, we've had a great online chat going among some Bloomberg watchers and economy wonks, people like Errol Lewis from New York One, Heidi Moore from The Guardian, Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute, and former Bloomberg aide and ardent fan Stu Lozer. When you get a chance, people, go read the text of their conversation on whether Bloomberg made us richer at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We have a couple of the participants joining us to bring some of it onto the air. And we start with Stu Lozer, who had been a Democratic political strategist before working for the mayor. He had even worked for Mark Green against Mike Bloomberg's original election in 2001, but then became one of Bloomberg's fiercest and most articulate boosters within the administration, which he has now left. He's now back in the private sector. So, Stu, thanks so much for coming on, and welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me back.
And your first post in the online chat included a version of this quote from the mayor. I'm not sure this is the exact one, but when he said something like this.
We want rich from around this country to move here. We love the rich people. They're the ones that buy in the stores so that people that work in the stores have jobs and the stores generate sales tax. The rich are the ones that go to the expensive restaurants.
That was Mayor Bloomberg, I think, from 2009 on his WOR show. And some people, when they've heard that, have thought, ooh, catering to the rich, so upfront about it, yuck. But you posted it. So how do you hear the meaning of it?
Well, it was on his radio show. It was March of 2009. So as I'm sure everyone remembers, but I'll say anyway, we were just beginning to really gear up for re-election. And as you can imagine, both our opponents and many of our supporters, including some of our staff, including some of our campaign people, were somewhere between outraged and apoplectic, but it is sort of the essence of Bloombergism. The mayor, Mike Bloomberg, sees New York as being in competition with a number of cities around the world, a small number of cities around the world: London, Berlin,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong, as places for people to go and create wealth. He believes that we're never going to be able to convince people not to create wealth and not to act in their own economic self-interest. So what we have to do is convince them to be here, book the deals here, let us tax the corporate taxes here, let us tax their income, let us tax the real estate when they buy the real estate or the $15,000 watches, and that is how we are going to pay for virtually doubling the city's expenditures in schools, increasing expenditures in parks, repairing our infrastructure, so on and so forth. That's the money comes from taxing the rich, and the last thing we should be doing is trying to disincentivize the rich from living here.
So you called it essentially Bloombergian. Is it also Reagan-esque? Has the strategy been trickle-down economics?
It's not. Well, trickle-down economics is a theory that trickle-down economics is a theory that if you lower taxation on people, you will get them to do more business, and that will trickle down. That's not what we've done. Mike Bloomberg came in and he raised property taxes 18%. Keep in mind, property taxes is the only tax that we can raise or lower ourselves.
Meaning without permission from Albany.
Correct. We have in New York a very progressive, steeply progressive personal income tax. You can reasonably argue that it should be more progressive. You should reasonably argue that it treats someone who earns $500,000 the same as someone who earns $500 million, and there should be grades in there. But the rich pay more taxes, and it's not really a trickle down. It's pretty simple. If rich people leave or spend less than half of their nights in a year here, then we don't get to tax them in the same way. If business deals get booked in London or in Hong Kong, a chief concern of ours coming in. Well, first of all, our chief concern of the city, of the mayors coming in, was the widespread belief that New York's best days were behind us and that we were going to lose out to cities like London for all mm-hmm. kinds of reasons related to the September 11th attacks.
Right.
But equally important, or even more important, was the simple fact of time zones. London was gaining on us because more and more important deal work was being done in Europe, in the Middle East, and London is if you're going to be in a time zone that's, say, 8 or 9 hours ahead of New York, you'd rather be doing business with London, which is much closer to your time zone than New York. We faced a problem of you can't fix time zones, but it's a problem that's exacerbated by global telecommunications. You could do this business somewhere else. And if the deals aren't done in New York, and the profits aren't booked in New York, we don't get to tax it, and then we can't use it to build
right.
parks.
So let's take the next step. You've established that the mayor believed that we were in competition with London and other cities to get rich people to move here, to make investments here. Next question, how? You said he raised taxes, property taxes, didn't do it in kind of the Republican way of, you know, cutting taxes, cutting regulation, and hoping that that would grow a million businesses. So how do you look back on Mayor Bloomberg's strategy for attracting that international investment and those folks to live here?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, the property tax increase, which is actually before my time as a mayor, was important to keep the city solvent and assure business leaders that we were going to be able to pay our bills. We were going to be able to keep investing in the roads and in bridges, and the city wouldn't crumble. The central question is, you know, where to live, you know, what's fashionable, what's hot, is hard. It's not an easy thing to do. It's not a rational argument, and there's a significant pack mentality involved in this. If London becomes the hot place, something that we spent an awful lot of time, the world spent an awful lot of time thinking would happen, it's hard to point to one or another thing. It's not tolls or one or another idea. The mayor, Mike Bloomberg, has put made ideas sort of not just a coin of the realm. I think I've said this on your show before, mm-hmm. but like the coin of the realm, the most important thing you can offer as an aid to him are ideas. And to the degree that we are constantly trying new and exciting things that capture attention around the world, and people say, "Oh, they're doing, like, that's interesting. They're closing Times Square, and they're going to put up areas for pedestrians, or they're trying this in the schools, or they've built this new park under the Brooklyn Bridge or on Governor's Island." That, you know, a steady stream of good and new, interesting ideas, while maintaining and keeping your eye on traffic fatalities and all the and crime and everything else that you're supposed to do, and transforming the schools, brings people here. It's not simple. It's marketing isn't simple. You have to keep on trying. You have to keep at it every day.
Let me take a phone call. And my guest again is Stu Loser, former aide to Mayor Bloomberg. As we ask the question, has Mayor Bloomberg made us richer? Listeners, in your life, in your sector of the economy, for the city as a whole, in your opinion, 212-433-WNYC. And Zara in Borum Hill, did I say your name right?
Yes, you sure did, Brian.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I think, you know, for me, the biggest problem with the Bloomberg era and ongoing is what's going on with housing in the city. You know, and I mean, I can appreciate a strategy for attracting wealth, you know, but I think it's gone too far. I think the city has become a ghetto for the wealthy, basically. And his lack of any sort of, you know, thinking of any kind of regulation or something to keep the middle class in the city, not to keep pushing us out further out, you know, as neighborhoods become more and more gentrified. I mean, parts of the city are ghost towns. You know, you see these apartments where, the wealthy come and buy these places. They're kind of like safe deposit boxes in the sky. But I just think that, this absolute out of control rise in rents in the city is I think it's one of the most pressing issues going forward, and certainly in the next mayoral election, that's what I'm going to be judging the candidates by.
Zara, thank you very much for your call. And Stu, we hear this a lot. The candidates are hearing it a lot and reflecting it a lot on the campaign trail.
We do. Now, a couple of points, Brian. One is the mayor's 165,000-unit affordable housing plan, which is, last I checked, ahead of schedule, is by far the largest that's ever been, by far the largest that's being taken, tackled by any city in the country, and it rivals the Koch plans. And it does so, with all due respect to my hero, the late, great Mayor Ed Koch, not in a city in which there's an enormous amount of vacant buildings that can be taken over, is point one. Point two, yes, we hear it a lot. Absolutely, it was a concern. It was also a concern before Mike Bloomberg became mayor. I came back to New York after the Gore campaign and was shocked, not that I was looking at apartments far beyond Tompkins Square Park, which, you know, as someone growing up in New York, I remember it, these being places you would never go to, but being shocked that almost 10 years out of school, I couldn't afford to live on Avenue C, on 6th Street and Avenue C, that these apartments were, the apartments I could afford had sloping floors and were terrible, and the apartments that I couldn't afford, that were decent, I couldn't afford. And this was obviously before Mike Bloomberg. I mean, there is a problem that when you build the safest big city in America, when crime, when murders are below 500, when they've been at below, above 2,000, there is a supply and demand problem. There's, of course, an obvious solution, which we would never contemplate, which is allowing the quality of life in the city to decline, which would then bring down prices. It's a serious problem. It is not fair to say that we haven't addressed it, and it is, not to coin a phrase, but to use one of the mayor's, a problem, one of the mayor's phrases, a problem of success.
Most of the Democratic mayoral candidates are running in part on the idea that Mayor Bloomberg made rich people richer while the middle class is floundering, like the caller was saying, and that four of the five boroughs have been neglected. I put this, has Bloomberg made us richer, question to three of the candidates who were each successively on the show on different days this week. So let me play you a little montage of what John Liu, Christine Quinn, and Bill Thompson said.
Are you serious with that question? Has he made us richer? I think he has made some people richer in this city, probably the top 1%. The wealth gap is out of control in the nation. It's far worse in the city of New York.
There's no question that wealth has grown in some segments of New York City. There's also no question, and the mayor would agree with this, that we have a big disparity and, you know, big divergence in income equality.
Well, it appears that a few people have been made richer, but I think that the reality is that New Yorkers are struggling. When you look at the real numbers, half of the people in the city of New York are at or near the poverty line.
Bill Thompson there, Christine Quinn before him, John Liu before that, Stu Loser, former aide to Mayor Bloomberg, with us. And if they're running on that, and they almost gave identical answers, they must think it has resonance around the city. So if it's not true, why do you think the Bloomberg years would leave many people with that impression that he made rich people richer and not everybody else?
Look, I'm going to leave the political strategies for those people, some of whom I respect greatly, to answer for them. There is no doubt that income inequality has skyrocketed in this country over the last 10, 12 years, with last 10, 12, 20 years. Fundamentally, income inequality is very different than it was in 2003 and in 1993, in the sort of beginning of the Clinton years, in which income inequality, by the way, went up significantly. That's undoubtedly true. The central question really is, that we're talking about here, is it the mayor's fault? And I'm not sure that's the case. Income inequality is derived from the treatment of how federal law and how federal income tax law treats certain industries, particularly finance. It derives from the fact that we have great inequality in educational opportunity and the results of that in this country. And Mike Bloomberg has devoted an enormous amount, the most amount of effort out of anything he's done in New York City, in his time in office, to addressing that, to turning around the schools. There's widespread. You could disagree with the mayor on this or another aspect of mayoral control, and that's not the purpose of this discussion, although many of the critics are wrong. But without a doubt, he has dedicated an enormous amount of effort into turning around a school system that previously worked for the political appointees and the people who worked in the schools and tried to make it work much better for the students, delivering better education. It's not something that's not going to fix income inequality in 5 years. If anything, it will fix it in 20 years. The point of this discussion is, has Mike Bloomberg done it? The answer is no. John Liu is wrong. The answer is Mike Bloomberg hasn't done it. What he has done is recognizing that some people are extraordinarily rich. He has tried to get them to come here so that we can continue to help them support people who are struggling and people who just come here penniless, which is the great New York tradition.
Stu, I'm going to ask you one more question, and I appreciate you giving us this time today. I read a Greg David piece in Crain's yesterday praising the mayor that said, as many jobs that have been lost on Wall Street as that sector changes have been added in the tourism industry thanks to the mayor's growth strategy for that sector. But I wonder about the implications of that. A lot of tourism jobs are pretty bad, low-paying jobs. Some are decent. I read another stat that food service is the fastest-growing single job category in the city. So is the city becoming less a professional center and more a low-wage service job-oriented place to be? And is that something that the mayor has tried to facilitate or tried to avoid?
And I skimmed Greg's piece. Greg's piece said, and it's using information from the Independent Budget Office, that the average compensation on Wall Street, average, is $360,000, a little over $360,000 a year.
But there aren't as many of them. A lot of those jobs have gone away.
But, you know, that's interesting because during 2008, during 2009, during the financial crisis, we constantly heard people talk about average compensation on Wall Street, which is higher. The median compensation, meaning if you take everyone who works in finance and industry, finance and insurance and not real estate, in the five boroughs, you line them up, the man or woman in the middle makes about $87,000, $90,000, $91,000 a year, depending on which borough it is, Staten Island a little more, Bronx a little bit less. But solid middle-class jobs in the finance industry, which incidentally nobody talks about, a few people talk about, and when we sort of bash the rich, we forget that there's an awful lot of solid middle-class jobs that come out of that. A matter of fact, much more than half of the jobs, the finance jobs in New York, are solid middle-class jobs, number one. Number two, you know, manufacturing, this is something we talked about on the branch, manufacturing in the city of New York has disappeared in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s. It left New York, left the Northeast and went to the South and then went to China and now has moved inland in China. Without a doubt, manufacturing and technology, so legal secretaries, Partnership for New York City, a client of mine, put out a blueprint report earlier this year, which everybody should go read, for the next mayor. And it among the issues it discussed is how technology has replaced a lot of middle-class jobs because you don't need legal secretaries, you don't need administrative assistants. The jobs have just disappeared. Word processing and LexisNexis have done what the disappearance of manufacturing did in an earlier generation. Right. The question is, what are you going to do about it? And the answer is, Mike Bloomberg, you know, without a doubt, has relentlessly pursued tourism, relentlessly advertised, and pushed, and our strategy to try to get people to visit here with new attractions and new events, without a doubt, has brought people here. And yes, many of those jobs don't pay as much as you would like. Although, let's be clear here, if you get to work in a unionized hotel, you have a very solid middle class upbringing, a very solid middle class background. Yeah. You do extraordinarily well. But what would the alternative be? We have people coming here from around the world because with limited English skills because they think they're going to be able to do better for them. And we have built up an industry that allows them to get a foothold in the way that manufacturing served for my grandparents. And by the way, they didn't have unionized jobs, and it wasn't so great working in a pencil factory on the west side of Manhattan. And that, coupled with turning around the public schools, gives people a real opportunity. It's not something you're going to see in 5 years or 10 years or 12 years or 20 years, but in the long term, it's the best approach anyone has.
One of Mayor Bloomberg's closest aides for much of his time in office, Stu Loser. Stu, thanks so much, and let's keep talking.
Okay.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll continue in a minute with another of the participants in our online chat. By the way, when Stu referred to Branch, the conversation on Branch, that's the name of the program that we used that makes it very easy for them to post and very easy for them to read. So go check that out at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to see the online chat that has taken place over the last several days among all these folks on the question, has Mayor Bloomberg made us richer? And we'll talk in a minute to one of the other participants, Era Lewis from New York One, and we'll take more of your calls, 212-433-WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Did Michael Bloomberg make us richer? If you're just joining us, we've had a great online chat going on that question this week among some Bloomberg watchers and economy wonks. When you get a chance, go read the text of their conversation on whether Bloomberg made us richer at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. With us, another one of the participants, Era Lewis, host of The Road to City Hall on New York One, which airs weeknights at 7 and 10 p.m. Hi, Era. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
And I see you just tweeted that Stu Loser gave a thoughtful defense of Bloomberg economic policy. You want to react to anything?
Yeah. I mean, the metaphor that, if you wanted to use, I was thinking of was Mayor Bloomberg invited a lot of penthouse dwellers to move here from, say, London or Hong Kong or Berlin or someplace. And, you know, there's another view of how do we get more people in the penthouse, and that's to work on an elevator that takes them from the lower floor up to the higher floor. It's just kind of a different way of looking at this. And, and I think the mayor does have a lot to do with setting the tone and setting the policies. I mean, there's really no question about that.
And your first post in the chat said, it isn't the job of city government to make people richer, but rather to provide the foundations of upward mobility through a good education system, which Stu emphasized, and a conducive environment for business. And you weren't sure that the mayor did this as well for small businesses as for big ones and for the tech sector. What were you getting at?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're in the tech sector, you got a lot of attention from this administration. And just to take one example, the mayor, entirely on his own, I mean, I remember interviewing the deputy mayors and asking, look, was there any input on this? He came up with this, you know, admittedly interesting idea of what ended up being this big project that's going to happen on Roosevelt Island, setting up a competition, an international competition, and getting the universities to do this and putting a lot of effort into STEM. I think in dollar terms, you know, setting aside the fact that a bunch of land was really sort of allocated for this, I think the total dollar number that I recall was upwards of $400 million. Now, that level of creativity and that level of input could have gone in a lot of different directions, but he made a decision that, you know, this sector at this time by this means, and I'm not faulting that. I mean, it's a very good bet. It's a very smart move. It's going to probably or possibly work out very well for the city. But if you're a small business person who's just been hit with $1,000 worth of fines for what's in many cases fairly small violations, that's got to be a little bit galling. That, you know, some people get literally the red carpet rolled out for them. And some other people get an inspector who wants to sort of, you know, poke around in their kitchen and slap a bunch of fines on them.
And you think that was a conscious policy, that the mayor was using small businesses as kind of cash cows because they upped fines and upped enforcement of regulations and without regard to whether that were—
I don't know about that. I mean, I think anybody who has to write a ticket, whether it's for your water bill or, you know, a parking ticket, feels like they're being bled, you know. There's no question about that. So,
right.
But no, I mean, certainly nothing that nefarious or that direct. Mm. I just think that the attention of the mayor, and I think we heard this from Stu Loser, the attention of the mayor and the strategy of the mayor was directed toward a particular sector, a particular set of strategies. And the small business people have been saying, and I think the administration would have to acknowledge this, that they've been kind of left in the lurch, that you still have to go to whatever the crazy number of agencies is, 22 agencies or something like that, if you want to open a restaurant. And every year we heard that something was going to happen to make it easier. There was going to be a one-stop shop. There was going to be a concierge to help walk you through the paperwork. There's going to be less paperwork. There was going to be a review of why there's so much paperwork. And in the end, you know, if you talk to small business people, I think they would largely say that those were promises that weren't really kept to their satisfaction.
Let's take another phone call. Roy in Roosevelt Island, or on Roosevelt Island. You're on WNYC. Hi, Roy.
Hi. I'm glad to talk to you. Actually, I'm on the tram right now. In general, my comment is Bloomberg has made, obviously, the rich richer, but he has made the city poorer. I happen to be fortunate enough to have lived at the time when we had a real New York mayor, LaGuardia. And what he did for the city was for the whole city, for every stratum, for every level of talent and ability. He created things like the Music and Art High School.
But why do you say, if you were, Roy, you were listening...
We had we had drama and art and music in public schools. It wasn't just a one size fit all test on how good you do in math and English. He was a man that came from the people and was concerned with the people. This mayor came from the rich and is concerned for the rich.
And Roy, I'm going to go because the line is
any laws or regulations that would make building and real estate go more smoothly and made it more difficult for mom and pop shops, for example, to stay afloat.
Roy, I'm gonna leave it there, and I think Roy can't hear me, but Roy, thank you. Keep calling us. Our first ever on-tram call, as far as I know. And Susan in Morningside Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. Thank you for taking this issue on, and no, I absolutely do not feel richer after 12 years of this administration. And as I was saying to your screener, and she put the word in my mouth, I was reaching for it. I mean, this focus is all about globalization, and they're just looking at, you know, making the world into a string of cities. There's a lot that's been written about this, and you know, from the obscure press about neoliberalism. But, you know, there's a very conscious effort to build chains of charter schools and even private schools, like Avenues, for instance, where Surrey Cruise goes. They want to build a chain among 20 cities throughout the world so that as those globalized people move around, they can plug down into a place that will be familiar. And, you know,
but
as
Susan,
a New York
so
City
what
parent,
would what Stu was saying earlier is that the mayor's point is those globalized rich people who you're referring to are going to spend their money somewhere. So he's not, or New York's not, going to be able to change that reality. So New York's best off trying to compete for their business here and even for their residents here. Why not?
Look what happened. I happen to know, you know, someone who lives in a building where a well-known pundit lives. And she spends exactly half a year in Florida, so she doesn't have to pay any taxes, and, like, you know, one day less in New York City, so she doesn't pay any New York City taxes. Well, what good does that do any of us?
Right, if she does that. Susan, thank you very much. Era Lewis, any reaction to either of those first two callers?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think these are common things that you hear, is that, you know, people have a vision of how they want to live in this city and what this city can be for them. And in a lot of cases, that is just very different from the vision that this administration laid out. And, you know, it is perfectly fair to say, well, hey, we had an election. Bloomberg can say, I think, honestly, that he never deceived anybody about what he was planning to do or why he was planning to do it or what benefits they might get if it were all to work out. You know, I mean, I thought the number that was cited from Greg David's article And what Stu Lozier said about the median income on Wall Street is good. I mean, it's good to know. It's important to know. You know, Wall Street isn't just a bunch of limo riding, former frat boys who are smoking cigars and spilling champagne all over the place. It's also a lot of people who are clerks and runners and drivers and chefs and all kinds of other people who benefit from that trade. I mean, I was part of the tail end of some of that stuff back in the 1980s when I was doing legal proofreading as a temp job, and it paid what I needed at the time, and I was grateful for the work. But there's another way to look at all of this stuff, and that's what I think the administration has been, I don't want to say tone deaf, but they've just, they've said, look, we've got our strategy, and this is what we're going to do. And if you don't like it, run somebody against us, or other than that, live with the benefits, and try another direction when you have a new mayor, which I think is, to a great extent, what this season is really about among the mayoral contenders, a different vision of how do you create prosperity, for artists, for everybody, for people who have kind of, I won't bore you too long, but I'll tell you a very, very quick story about my best friend in the whole world. He's an architect. He comes here. He gets a rent-stabilized apartment. He is, paying what is really just, it's scandalously low. Let's put it that way, right? Mm-hmm. And he's had it for, 30 years. But in that 30 years, he became a tenured professor at a public university here in the city. He's teaching other kids. He's had a fantastic career, and he has paid that subsidy back many times over. But he never would have had the chance if there wasn't like a $600 or $700 apartment here for him. And you try to grab people by the lapels at City Hall and say, this is vitally important. You've got to keep this stuff available. And they tell you what they're doing, and, that's fine. But it doesn't make their eyes light up, the way their eyes light up when they talk about we've got whatever the number is now, 59 billionaires who live here, and they're paying some ridiculous percentage of the freight of the total taxes, and we can't let even one of them think about leaving. You kind of wish that, I wish they'd think that way about guys like my friend.
We talked on the show the last 2 days about that new Harvard-Berkeley study about upward mobility, in which New York City fared better than most other American cities. And they attributed it a lot to poor kids being less isolated here because of good mass transit and not living in closer proximity, or I should say living in closer proximity to the middle class and the wealthier people here than in places like Atlanta and Chicago and Detroit, where the poor are more segregated and have a harder time commuting to jobs outside their neighborhoods. I'm curious if you happen to see that study or have a reaction to it in New York City policy terms and how it relates to the things we've been talking about.
Well, it's certainly very true. I mean, I remember I was involved in a project where down in New Orleans before Katrina, before the flood, and one of the most intriguing things that they were working on was a reverse commute project. Down there, there were a lot of shipbuilding yards, and they needed work, and it was relatively lower-skilled work, so it was a good entry-level work. But you had to figure out how to get kids from the inner city of New Orleans out to these suburban areas, and it wasn't easy to figure out because it was kind of a reverse commute. Here the MTA makes the city go. I mean, if you hadn't figured that out when they shut down the train system around hurricane time, I think everybody understood that.
We didn't need a Harvard economist to tell us that.
Well, exactly, and I think just as you say, I mean, being able to get around and to see different ways of living is extremely important. I don't think if you're not around kids a lot, I think people forget that, a 12, 13, 16-year-old, they don't really know the range of options that are out there for them. And it's just by passing through the garment district and seeing that there's like a sewing shop or guys pushing racks. I think there's still a few of those guys left.
But you can
sort of stop somebody and say, well, gee, how do you guys do this? How do I get in?
I think there's one other thing as we run out of time that we really need to mention if we're assessing the Bloomberg legacy on did he make us richer. And that's the flip side of how much loss of prosperity did he stave off? Because I think it's fair to say that Mayor Bloomberg was first elected in 2001 largely because it was 2 months after 9/11, and voters thought he would be better than Mark Green at helping the economy recover from the awful financial shock of the attacks. Obviously, we think about the people killed, but it was also an unbelievable financial shock to New York. And then again in 2009, the reason he got away with the undemocratic term limit suspension was that people felt he was so well qualified, almost uniquely qualified, to help us recover from the financial crisis. So do you agree with that version of history, first of all? And did he do it? Do you think he brought special skills to bear for those two outside crises that bookended the decade and that we did benefit from that?
The first, I'd say yes to the first and almost certainly no to the second. The first, yes, the trauma of 9/11, you literally had to convince people, look, don't put your back office on the other side of Timbuktu. Don't leave. We're going to reopen the stock exchange. We're going to make this thing work. On the other hand, in 2009, the polling actually showed that when he ran around talking about that rationale, that, oh, it's a financial crisis, I'm the guy to head us through it, the voters actually rejected that. And if you go back and look through the race carefully, he actually stopped talking about it. I mean, that famous encounter he had with Ozzie Pabara, where Ozzie Pabara was asking that question, and he said, you're a disgrace. Well, that was the question he was asking. He was saying, well, look, if the economy's coming back, doesn't that undermine your rationale? And he reacted, famously.
Yes.
But could it have been worse? Yes. In fact, I don't want anybody to interpret anything I said as in any way downplaying or disparaging the competence of this administration in executing their strategy. I think the questions that are on the table that are worth asking is, are there other strategies that maybe deserve some consideration, and maybe it's time for us to take a look at some of those? I mean, go back to that metaphor. I mean, to me, I would say, economically speaking, the elevator's broken. There are people who are stuck on the lower floors. They're trudging up the stairs, and they see a big party happening up in the penthouse. And, nobody should be surprised if they don't want to cheer for all those people up in the penthouse. They're trudging up the stairs, and they're saying, look, when are we going to get the elevator fixed? We got to get up there.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there with Errol Lewis, who, by the way, I'm going to be working with a lot, and you'll be seeing or hearing us a lot together next month. On Monday, August 12th, Errol and I will be co-moderating the first Spitzer-Stringer debate for the Democratic nomination for New York City Comptroller, and then we're doing a public advocate debate and a mayoral debate that Errol will moderate, and I'll be one of the questioners in. We'll tell you much more about that, and Errol's going to come on the show a couple of times around those debates. So, Errol, I look forward to our partnership in August.
Yes, indeed. Looking forward to it.
And I want to draw people's attention one more time to the whole online chat on the question, did Mayor Bloomberg make us richer? It's a really good read between Errol and Stu Loser, who was on earlier, and Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute, and Heidi Moore from The Guardian, and me at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You'll see the box for Has Bloomberg Made Us Richer? And maybe the most interesting thing in the whole 3 days of the online chat was the thread between Errol and Nicole about public housing. So go read it, and maybe we'll get a chance to bring that one on to the air on another day. Errol, thanks again.
All right. Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, for this day before I go away for 2 weeks, what should I and other summer vacationers read and listen to? Give us a book and a blurb, folks. Suggest your best recent fiction, nonfiction, and music of any genre. Who's got one? 212-433-WNYC.